Hey, this is Bhavin, Professor Gan's class. The course name is Trust Asset. Today's date is November 7th. This is podcast 1 and the room number is 230.
Different frequency.
That's fine.
No, that's not fine. Whoever's doing the walkthroughs in the morning needs to have this pointed out. Where is this not here right now? Why should we know about it?
I don't know why.
That is my point. Oh, that is the mic.
Found it?
Yeah, it was here all along. It was in the drawer.
I picked up. Okay, good.
Thank you. There you go. Good job. Okay, let's get going. Okay, let's get started. I want to talk today about revocation. Revocation of a will. Now, I've mentioned this before, but let's start with this notion that wills are ambulatory. And I think I've used that word before in talking about wills. And of course, what I mean by that is that they can be moved around and changed. That they are, put it better, I suppose, completely revocable, right? Because we know that you can change your will anytime you want, so you can revoke your prior will at any time. Now, the statutes on revocation provide essentially three different methods by which one can revoke. So we've got three methods for revocation. This is kind of a little bit similar to the statute of wills, right? We talk about executing a will. We know we need a certain kind of ceremonial process. Certain requirements must be met in order for the will to be valid. Similarly, when we are revoking a will, we have methods that the statute sets forth that must be followed as well. Now, in the UPC, you'll find the statute dealing with revocation is in UPC 2-507. And in the New York, our revocation statute is EPTL 3-4.1. Okay, so those are the two statutes now that we'll be looking at. You need to hear that again? 3-4.1. Okay. Now, essentially, I think I said there are three methods by which one can revoke a will. The first method is by embodying the revocation in a validly executed will. By placing the revocation or effecting the revocation through a validly executed will. That makes sense, right? Does that make sense? We've talked repeatedly about how you can have a clause in your will. In fact, I've suggested as a practical matter, you always start in a will. Whenever you're drafting a will, you should always start with a revocation clause, which revokes all prior wills. And once you do that, of course, you are operating on a clean slate. Everything else that you've previously done is gone and revoked, and now you're operating on a clean slate. Okay, and that's, in fact, what we typically do. Now, so that's the first method. The second method is this. You can effect the revocation by a writing executed in accordance with the statute of wills. You can effect the revocation by a writing executed in accordance with the statute of wills. Now, if I were sitting in your shoes, what I would be thinking at this moment is, what the heck is the difference between the first method and the second method? Why do we have two different methods? They look awfully similar. Do they not? Any ideas why do we have a different method here in two? As distinguished from one. Yes? Anybody else? You have an idea? No? Well, think about this case. Let's say I do adopt. Let's say, you know, you're in a hospital and the client says to you, the client is ill, seriously ill, and the client says to you, look, I'd like to revoke my prior will. You know, I just want to get rid of it. So you say, well, you know, if you revoke your will, you're going to go back to the intestacy. The client says, okay, that's fine for me. Just revoke your will. Okay? And you say, okay, so you prepare a piece of paper. And in the piece of paper, you write down, and you write it out. You know, maybe you take it out of your handwriting. You say, I give my revoke all prior wills. And then you have two witnesses come in, or you act as one of the witnesses, and there's a second witness there, right? And you go through the requirements of the statute of wills. Okay, you know, you do whatever you have to do. If you're in New York, is this your will? Yes, you want to act as a witness. You know, the typical routine that we've been through. Client signs, is that a valid revocation? Yes. That's a good revocation. Now, what is the difference between this and the first case? In the first method, I talked about a new will. So, the difference between these two cases, between a new will, which is method number one, and the second method, which is the type where I describe running the hospital, is that in the second case, I make no dispositions of my property. The only thing I've done in the will, in the document, is to revoke my prior wills. You with me? See the difference? So the difference is, in the first case, you're doing a new will with affirmative dispositions of your property, and you are revoking prior wills. In the second case, all you are doing is revoking the prior will, and you are making no affirmative disposition in the document, and that's perfectly fine, perfectly acceptable. Make sense? Obviously, it should be acceptable, and that you're complying with the statute of wills. Why do we require this? You want to make a new will, you've got to comply with statute of wills. You want to revoke what you've got, you can do it by complying with statute of wills. And essentially what we're saying to boil this down, simple terms, is there's no requirement that you put in the will affirmative provisions, affirmative dispositions, in order to make this a valid revocation. Okay, I think that's pretty straightforward. Any questions? The third method, which I think I'll spend some time with, kind of interesting. Interesting from the perspective of trying to understand the law in this area, but I think as a practical matter, this third method doesn't get used that much. We see cases about it because people have their problems that occur in connection with this third method. But we don't. As a lawyer, I would recommend not to use this third method. The third method is revocation by what I would call physical act. Revocation by physical act. Now, just to repeat what I'm saying, I think most lawyers, as a practical matter, will spend their careers, their trust and estate lawyers, revoking wills by drafting new wills which have a revocation clause in the first and the beginning of, you know, somewhere in the wills, and revocable rights. And that's how most lawyers effect revocation. But there is this third method that can be used, and I think you tend to see it more, perhaps, with lay people. Don't have to learn more if you want to effect revocation. But there is this third method by which revocation can be effected. And it's what I say, what I call a revocation by physical act. Now, what does this mean? What does physical act mean? What am I talking about? Well, the statute will use words like this. If you take a look at the UPC, the section I've cited, or the New York section I've cited, we'll use words like burning, tearing, got a series of words in there. Burning, tearing, cutting, canceling, obliterating, fill in the rest of the words. The test there? Or the will? Obviously not the test. We're not going to cancel or burn the test. Okay. So we're going to do this to the will. So the first element is physical act, right? Meaning a burning, a tearing, a obliteration of the document, of the will. Okay? Now, who has to do this act? And the answer is, what do you think? Intestate. So as a general matter, the act is performed by intestate. Yes? Yeah, good question. She says, what happens if you had, let's be clear here. Let's speak very carefully about your question, okay? Let's be very careful and, you know, move your opinions. She says, what happens if you have more than one will? Right? Got the question? Now, the reason why I want to be careful with you is because I want to know what you mean by more than one will. So, for example, if I were doing a will execution, I would execute one original. I have a document, client will sign it, the witnesses will sign it, and that would be my only original. Right. Now, I might have Xerox copies, you know, I might have Xerox copies of the will, but I would only have one original. And so, in that case, if I ripped up, let's say I ripped up the original, would that affect the valid revocation? Yes. With me? Let's say I ripped up one of the Xerox copies. Would that affect the valid revocation? No. So I've got it. If I rip up the original and I leave all the copies intact, that's a valid revocation. If I rip up a copy, that's not a valid revocation. Now here's a hard question, which I think is implicit to the question you've asked, but I've avoided it so far. So now let me ask a hard question. What would happen if you had two originals, which I usually would not do, but we'll see why later. I'm getting a little bit later, you're kind of anticipating this problem. We'll talk about it later. But I typically, in practice,
having two rhythms. We'll see why a little bit later today. But in any event, for the moment, just to take your question, I believe that if I had two originals and I destroyed one of the originals, and by the way, you don't have two originals. In other words, the testator executed two wills, and the witnesses executed both documents. Now, I believe in that case that if the testator were to destroy one of the originals, that would trigger a revocation. That would trigger a revocation. And if you're interested, if you take a look at the Harrison v. Byrd case, which we'll discuss a little bit in a while, it's implicitly in the case. There were two originals in that case. And it's pretty clear that a revocation, the destruction of one of the originals, is sufficient to trigger a revocation. Okay? Clear? Well, together? Okay. Now, coming back. Okay. So we've got revocation by one of these methods of physical act. You see why I'm calling it physical act, right? Physical act of ripping the thing up or canceling it in some way. How about putting X's through the pages? I think that would work, putting an X through each page. I think it would work if you put an X through the signature line. In other words, if you put the X through some critical part of the will, I think that would be sufficient. Okay, and we'll come back and look at this a little bit later as well. Now, I said as a general matter, the testator must perform the act. That's what I said. As a general matter, the testator must perform the act. Now I'm going to give you an exception to that general rule. There is a kind of what I would call a hospital room exception to that general rule. So let's think about the hypo. Let's think about how we can illustrate this exception. We're in the hospital room. And testator wants to revoke their will. You know, we're called in to get there. Testator says, look, I just want to revoke my will. How do I do it? Okay? Now, what do you think? Well, one thing, what do you think? How would we do it? What would you recommend? Call a lawyer. Right. Okay. What would you do? Give it to a lawyer. Well, one thing you could do is what we said before. You could take out a piece of paper, and you could say, I hereby revoke my will, right? And you could call in another witness, and you could not. And you'd execute it towards the statute of wills, and that would be fine. Another method. What's another method? Do you have the will with you? Yes, I have it right here. Testator could rip it up. So you want to revoke it? Yeah, just rip it up. Good. Done. Next is rip it up. Any one of these acts would be sufficient to revoke it. Now, let's say you don't want to impose this on the testator, on the client. You know, if it's possible that you're going to sit there, you're going to have to put an X through it or whatever, can't rip it up. Can you do the act on their behalf? Can the client say, yes, I want you to revoke it, good, I'm ripping it up. What do you think? Well, the answer is yes. These statutes, the revocation statutes, pretty much around the country, make an exception here and permit someone else to act, to do the act on behalf of the testator. So, in New York, now we're making a distinction between New York and New York City. In New York, if I want to do this, I have to have, according to our statute, if you look at 3.4.1, it says that I have to have two witnesses present. So it has to be done in the presence of two witnesses. And I can't be counted. So in other words, testator's there, I have all the two nurses, and I rip it up, and I've got two witnesses who watch me rip it up, perfectly valid. Under the Uniform Probate Code, on the other hand, I can do it without witnesses. I can just rip it up in the presence of the testator. You know, the testator's telling me to do it. I can rip it up and thereby revoke it, and I don't need the extra two witnesses. So again, if you're looking for a theme here, UPC is, of course, requiring less formality, right? UPC is more willing to, not require or not rigidly require all kinds of extra things. So the UPC is taking a kind of a more, efficient approach, less formality, as compared to New York, which still requires two additional. Give me one more moment, and I'll be quiet. I want to say this, whenever I do this, I always, whenever I talk about it this way, I have the urge to tell you that It's not, I've set it up, by, I've illustrated it by talking about a hospital. But I don't want to imply to you that this only occurs, this section only applies in a hospital. It could apply to anyone. It could apply to someone who's perfectly healthy. And I'm with them and they want to revoke their will. I can rip it up for them, and you occupy two witnesses, and it's good. All done in presence. All present. Or UPC to repeat, I can do it in the presence of the testator without the extra 2 weeks. Okay, yes.
The testator
is destroying the document
himself,
and taking any witnesses? No. Good point. If the testator, that's very important that we understand, we get that clear up. She says, what if the testator destroys the document himself or herself? You know, I get up in the middle of it, and this is really the thought, right? I get up in the middle of the night, and this is an important point. I really, where I was going. I get up in the middle of the night, I'm all by myself, I get my will out. I look at it and I say, I really made a mistake with this will, I really changed my mind or whatever, I want to revoke it. So I rip it up. Is that a valid revocation? And the answer is yes. That is a valid revocation. It comes out that that's those facts, perfectly valid revocation. Now, don't you find that troubling? Isn't that a bit troubling? In other words, here we are, we spend so much time talking about statute rules and how you have to have certain formalities, the ceremonial process and witnesses, you know, so that we know you really did this, right? We're really very, very concerned about that. And before we permit the will to be valid, we want all this ceremony and witnesses. And yet, now we see that if someone wants to go the other way and revoke the will, right, instead of having it going toward a will, go instead away from the will, back to intestacy, here we say, you don't have to have witnesses. What accounts for this asymmetrical kind of thinking? But on the one side, we need all this ceremony and witnesses. On the other side, we require so little. No witnesses, merely ripping it up, and we're willing to accept it as a valid revocation. How does one explain that lack of symmetry? Why is the law all of a sudden dropping all of its requirements and saying, just rip it off and we'll accept it. No witnesses required. What's going on? Anybody? Okay. People listening to this online probably think, oh my gosh, we have 10 people in this question. Okay. Here's the answer, I think. This is the best I can make for this. The best I can make. I think we're perfectly prepared. The law is perfectly comfortable allowing people to move away from intestacy. To a will, right? You don't like your intestate makers? Fine. You want to leave all your money to your friends rather than your family? Fine. We're willing to accept it. Right? But, of course, we want to make sure that everything is proper. That there's nothing going on here that's troubling. And so what we do is we say, okay, before you can move away from what might be considered a natural disposition of intestacy to something like a friend or some pattern that deviates from such a natural disposition, we want you to show us that this was properly done, that you really wanted this, we have witnesses and so on. And once we're comfortable, once we can get comfortable with the fact that you really wanted this, and you know the witnesses were there telling us it was really you, once we can get comfortable with that, we are perfectly, and we think there's no one who would influence a lack of capacity or fraud, we are perfectly comfortable giving you what you want. Right? But the hurdle is somewhat, I don't want to call it high, but we put a hurdle in front of you. We say, you want to go away from this natural disposition of intestacy to a more unnatural disposition, something you want to call, provide for your will. Fine, we're willing to do it, but we got to put a hurdle in front of you. We want to make sure, we want to be satisfied that everything is on the up and up. On the other hand, when we go from a will back to the state of intestacy, back to a more natural disposition, there, the hurdle is much lower. Because we're saying, okay, you're going back to a natural position. We're not as nervous about that. And therefore, we're more willing to accept more easily a movement back to the natural state of affairs, to the natural disposition. That make some sense? And therefore, we don't require witnesses and the same ceremony when you are revoking your will as we do when you are executing. Okay? Now, let's go back and pick up a point from last class. And I said last class I said I would come back to this. I wanted to get in at the end of class last time. And I'd like to go back to it now. If you remember, I talked toward the end of class last time about presumption against intestacy. Remember that? We talked about conditional wills, and in that context, I talked about a presumption against intestacy. And what we were saying there is that we have this presumption, it's rebuttable, but we have a presumption that we prefer to stay away from intestacy. A presumption against intestacy. And the question I want to ask is, how do we square what we discussed there, the presumption against intestacy, with what we're saying now? Because now we're saying, you know, if you want to go back to intestacy, we're happy. We're more comfortable. The law is more willing to let you do that without as much ceremony. So, doesn't it seem like I'm poking out both sides of my mouth? You see what I'm saying? What's the answer? Any ideas? Well, here's the clarification. When we talked about the presumption against intestacy, let's go back and think about the presumption against intestacy. Let's see how it comes up, how that presumption against intestacy becomes. When we're talking about the presumption against intestacy, here's what's going on. We have a valid will. We start with the premise that the will was validly executed. There's no question about its validity. What we're doing when we apply the presumption against intestacy is construing a valid but somewhat ambiguous will. That's the premise. That when we are invoking the presumption against intestacy, when dealing with a case where we're starting with a valid will, the question of validity is not on the table. No one's disputing validity. The question we're disputing is, what does this slightly ambiguous will mean? We're trying to construe an ambiguous will. So let's go back to the hypos we were using the other day at the end of the class, just to drive this point home and make it concrete. I guess the case we use the hypo like this, conditional will hypo. If I die on this trip to Europe, I give my money to X. Remember that? I go to Europe, and I return, and I don't die on the trip to Europe. But now, 5 days later, I die. And the question is, who gets the money? X or my intestate heirs? Remember this question? And what do we say? We're going to lean, which way do we lean? We know we have a valid will. When I did that hypo, I never said anything which would suggest that there were questions about validity of the will. Clear, it's our premise that the will was properly executed. We were construing this ambiguous will. And we said, now that we know we have a valid will, we're going to lean in the direction of giving the testator what they wanted. So on questions of construction, if the question is, should we let this go to X, or instead say, no, the testator didn't intend it to go to X in this case, if we go back to intestacy, we're going to lean away from intestacy and in favor of giving intestacy what they wanted, because they told us they wanted X to get the money. So we try to effectuate intestacy's wishes. But if we're dealing with a question of validity instead, which is what we're dealing with revocation, right? We're saying, you know, we, in terms of whether this is a valid document, we're a little bit more comfortable with the natural disposition of intestacy. You want to move away from that? Fine. But we want some real ceremony. When you move back to the state of intestacy via revocation, you know what? We're not going to require as much ceremony. We're not too uncomfortable going back to the natural state of affairs. Clear? Questions? Okay. Now, in order to have a valid revocation, there must always be, as a general matter, there's going to be a little exception that I want to account for, but as a general matter, very pervasive general matter, I don't even want you to worry about the exception right now. one of the essential ingredients is there must be an intent to revoke. So, here's a hypo, which will illustrate this point, I think. Let's say I have a wheel. And the wheel, I have the original, and the lawyer prepared it for me, and I take it home. Now, some time later, there's a fire in the house. I'm killed, and the will is destroyed. Was that a valid is that a valid revocation? Now you notice there's a destruction. So we start thinking about methods of revocation. We started the class by saying there are three methods of revocation. One is by a writing executed towards the statute of will. The second is by a new will. The third is by this lap. So we know the first two methods, we have no writing here. The first two methods are not on the table. But the third method, physical act, could be. So the question is, do we have a revocation by physical act here when the will is destroyed in the fire? No. Because? No, I had no intent to revoke it. Got it? That sets up kind of an interesting point that you might want to observe. And that is that it's now plausible, it's now conceivable, and we'll talk a little bit more about it later, but it's now conceivable that you can have a will that could be admitted to probate as a valid will, even though it no longer physically exists. Isn't that kind of counterintuitive? You would think that if the document ceases to exist because it's been destroyed, that you might not be able to get that will admitted to probate. But yet here we find that if there's no intent to revoke, it's not revoked. Similarly, another hypo, someone gets a hold of my will and rips it up. Does that affect the valid revocation? Of course not. Again, no intent to revoke. Now, another point closely related to intent to revoke is capacity. Capacity. Just like you need testamentary capacity to do a will, you need testamentary capacity to revoke a will. And so, if I rip up the will, or do any other form of revocation, any of the three methods of revocation, when at a time when I'm lacking in capacity, the revocation will not be valid. Make sense? For the same reason, we don't need to go back to this, but when we talked about capacity, we talked about why the law requires capacity on the execution side. But for the same reasons, we're not going to allow you to revoke a will if you lack capacity. Okay, and so sometimes you can see arguments like this. Well, they did revoke the will, but when they revoked it, they lacked capacity to do so. And therefore, the revocation is annulled. It's invalid. The revocation is not suspected. Okay, now, another aspect of revocation. If the revocation is done by writing in a will, so let's say now you do it by writing and it's in a will, there are two ways by which the revocation can be accomplished. One way, and this is the way it's typically done all over the place, and the lawyer will do it this way, as I've said, is by an express revocation clause. An express revocation clause. You know, I hereby revoke all prior wills. Express revocation clause. No question about it. And as I say several times now, that's the way lawyers do it. Now, another way that it could be accomplished. Second way by which revocation could be accomplished is by inconsistency. So the first way is express revocation clause. The second way or method would be by inconsistency. So let's take an example of inconsistency. In will number one, I say that I give my house to A. give my house to A. In will number two, I don't have a revocation clause. Could have one, which case would be express revocation clause, but I don't put one in. This tends to be, these are the kinds of wills that tend to be done by lay people without the assistance of lawyers. And this is case conference. So in will number two, they don't realize they need to put an express revocation clause in, and instead they simply say, I give my house to B. Who gets the house? By way of God, who gets the house?
A or B?
B. Why? Because it's the latest expression of the testator's intent. That's what the testator died wanted. Didn't change their mind. They didn't want to give it to A anymore. They wanted to go to B. They wanted it to go to B. And so therefore, the later inconsistent provision, if you will, squeezes out or renders revoked the earlier provision. So there's an example of the revocation by inconsistency. Make sense? Okay. Let's now take a look at Harrison versus Burke. Yes.
If will
number
one completely invalid in
that
scenario,
that's a good question. Let's take that question. She says, let's see if we can embellish a little bit. Let's say, I like that. I'm glad she asked that question. Let's say that will number one says, listen to this here. Will number one says, I give my house today. And I give my residue to Z. Okay? I give my house to A and I give my residue to Z. Everything's fine. Then one day I decide, you know, I don't like that anymore. I think what I'd like to do now is give my house to B. Okay? If I now write a new will, rule number two. And in will number two, all I say, and again, as a lawyer, I wouldn't do this, because it's why we should just have an express revocation clause. But let's say that in will number two, I say, I give my house B. That's all I do. And then I die. Who gets what? Who gets what? Who gets the house? He gets the house. Why? Because the gift of the house to A and will number one was revoked by this inconsistency. What about the residue? Who gets the residue? Z. Why Z? In will number one, Z gets the residue. And that gift, was it or was it not? Was it ever revoked? Was the gift of the residue ever revoked? No. Remained perfectly intact. The only thing that happened in will number two was a revocation of the gift of the house to A. There was never a revocation in will number two of the residuary gift to Z. Do you see that? Is that clear? I'm going to make a case in a little while where it would be helpful if you're clear about that. That's why I was glad you asked that question. Everybody clear?
Good.
Okay, now, Harrison, you first. Now, what happens in this case is the will gets executed with a lawyer. And the lawyer keeps the original. Relevant to a question before, earlier today over here, it turns out that there were two originals that were executed. Not typically done, but in this case they did. And in fact, the text-edge friend was given the other original, and the lawyer kept it. So now we have two originals out there. The lawyer's got one. The friend's got another. And then what happens is that the testator telephones the attorney one day and says, you know, I want to revoke my will. Could you revoke my will? Attorney says, sure, no problem. And what the attorney does is he goes to the file, and holds out the will, the original. Lawyers tend to keep these things in a vault so they're safe. They won't be destroyed in case of the process. Not that fire would revoke them, but it would certainly make things messy in terms of, you know, you don't know what it said. You know, you've got difficulties, practical difficulties when you have a non-existent will, you want to get rid of the program. We'll talk about how to surmount those difficulties in a little while. But in any event, so the lawyer probably kept his will in a safe place, takes it out of a safe place, rips it up. So the lawyer is thinking, what is the lawyer thinking to himself personally? They're remembering this lecture they had from law school, right? Like the one you're getting to. And they're thinking, aha, I remember that you can do a revocation by physical act. All you gotta do is rip it up, or cancel it, or burn it, or do something. I'm ripping it up in small pieces. What do you think? Puts the pieces into an envelope. This is rather ridiculous. Takes the small pieces, stuffs all the pieces into an envelope, addresses the envelope to the testator, and sends it to the testator. The testator gets the envelope. Now, what do you think? Any questions? With the testator does. But let's stop there. Let's say right now, I give you no further facts. And my question is, has a valid revocation been effected by the attorney's actions? Why not? Physical act. The testator, as a general matter, must do the act. In this case, who did the act? The attorney, not the testator. So that troubles me. But what about that, what I call the hospital room exception? Acknowledging that you don't have to be in the hospital room to qualify for that exception. What about that exception I talked about? Where I remember the hospital I gave you? I'm in the hospital room with the client, or I'm at the client's home, and they ask me to revoke their will, and I say, do you have it? They give it to me, and I rip it off. And that could be a valid revocation. Assuming if we're in New York, we have two witnesses, in UPC, we don't need two additional witnesses. What do you think about that? Good? No good? Why won't it work? Will it work? Why not? Exactly. Because in this case, the critical distinction here is that the testator was not present. It was by telephone. And that's not present. Troubling, I suppose. Maybe the lawyer was concerned about how do we know it was really the testator? Could someone be imitating the testator? We want the testator to be present when that other person rips it up. But in any event, that's what the statute requires. Okay? And therefore, it's invalid. Now, any other ideas? In this case? Says you got this case. Right? And what are you going to think about? You got this case. This is the fact. The client walks into your office, they tell you, look, the attorney ripped up the will. It was clear that my relative here, my testator, really wanted this revocation. And you're telling me that I can't get the money? I'm an intestate taker. I'd like to go back to the business. And you're telling me that the person named in the will is going to get it because this wasn't a valid revocation? What can I do about this? What do you think? Any other ideas, or are you just out of ideas? Could be out of ideas, okay. I don't mean to be crude. What do you think? No other thoughts?
I just, well, really much that the witnesses don't have to be present, we still have the problem. Even if the testator was present when it was ripped up, the testator said, well, he can't say, he or she can't say, I was present when it was ripped up, so I don't really understand who's teleporting with Brent and saying,
I'm not sure I get your point. In other words, you're saying, I'm not sure I got your point. The testator telephoned the lawyer and said, rip it up. Yeah. The lawyer ripped it up. So you want to say that's not a good revocation?
Yeah, because you don't have to.
So you don't have any argument. You're going to tell me, if I'm the client, you're going to tell me, sorry, you've got to lose it. Done.
You don't have any witness.
Yeah, not going to take your retainer. Anybody want to try to find a way to take your retainer? Yes.
Basically, you want to argue that the testator had the intent and he had the capacity.
Okay, good. Let's slow down. Slow it down. So one thing you want to say is, I agree. I mean, you're just underscoring what we talked about before, but I like it. You're saying clear that the testator had the intent to revoke. And it's also clear on our facts. I don't want to say otherwise. I haven't given you anything to suggest otherwise, the testator had to pass it. Now, I guess the reason why you're underscoring that, I guess, is because what's bothering you about this fact pattern is here we have a case where the testator's intent is clearly and perfectly expressed. We know what they wanted. And what we're running into is a technical rigidity in the law. You have to be present. A telephone is not good. By the way, what would have happened if it had been a video conference? That still wouldn't work. I don't think that's present. That still wouldn't satisfy the statute. And yet, we know what the testator wanted. We are, what's bothering you is we are, it seems like, the person down here, that what you're doing is you're saying, well, that's the technical requirement, and therefore the revocation is invalid, and the heck with what the testator intended. And that's bothering you. Right. We're now giving you a legal order.
Well, especially because, as we said in general, the law favors return to necessity when the intent is clear that it has to be present. Therefore, you should uphold the intent of the testator.
Okay. What's a legal doctrine that would get you there? No thoughts? Well, one thing you could think about is this. Yes.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Does the physical act begin with going to the attorney?
No, I don't think that would work. Let me just repeat what you said to make sure everybody understands why I don't think that would work. She said maybe she could argue that the physical act is calling the attorney and telling the attorney I want to revoke. And the answer is no, I don't think that would work because if you look at the statute says the physical act must be formed with respect to the document. It requires a physical cancellation, obliteration, mutilation, those are all the words, of the document itself. Exactly right. That's exactly what I had in mind. Could you argue harmless error or substantial compliance? Now, I'd like to raise this at this moment because this is our first moment to think about how these doctrines, substantial compliance and harmless error, might have application in the context of a revocation. Until this moment, when we talked about those doctrines, we confine them to the context of execution, a defect in the execution process. We executed the will, we didn't have the right witnesses, as in the Hall case, or in the Rand case, the witnesses signed in the wrong place, and we said, okay, we're going to remedy that through these doctrines. But for the first time we see the question, can these doctrines be brought to bear and have some help, give us some help, in the context of a faulty revocation? And the answer is yes. If you take a look at the UPC, for example, 2503, the harmless error statute in the UPC 2503, you will see that it explicitly references possible application not only to the execution, but also to the revocation process. So yes, if you have a slight defect in revocation, maybe you could argue, or certainly you could argue, that that should be excused under harmless error or substantial. 3.3 of the Restatement of Profit, which is the section of the restatement that deals with substantial compliance, also explicitly talks about how it could be made, that doctrine could be made applicable, could be applied in the case of a revocation, as well as in the case of execution. So this is the first time we see the applicability, potential applicability of doctrine on the revocation side. That's good. I like that all. I had another thought that I wanted to get out with you. If this case came into your office and you were thinking about what to do with it. The other thought I have two more thoughts actually, but one more thought I have is, you know, what occurs to me, the first thing that occurs to me is, goes through my mind, is stupid lawyer. Right? They remember only part of what they learned. They remembered that a revocation by a physical act is good, but they didn't remember that it had to be done either by the testator or by someone else in the presence of the testator. And so, whenever I think of a stupid lawyer, what's the next one? What does stupidity mean to them? Malpractice, right? So, one might think about suing an attorney for malpractice, but then that gets you into, what's the next issue when you start thinking about suing an attorney for malpractice? Only a state that requires privity. Okay, you have to look at that. All right, now let's go on with the facts. So that's all where we are, and now, you know, you've gone through this whole thought process with your point in your own head as you listen to these facts, but you say the point, all right, let me hear the rest of the story. Now, the rest of the story is that the client got pieces of the will in the mail, from his lawyer, and later on the client dies. That's different. Of course, we do have something. We want to move into the case. Testator dies, and the question now is this: is what happens now is, let me ask you, what else do you have? Any other ideas? Any other thoughts? Any other arguments? Well, if I were the lawyer, given what I know, I would say, where are they? Where are they? Why don't you ask that question? She says, where are they? And I'm going to be the point. And I'm going to say, oh, we looked at the house, we searched high and low, and couldn't be found. So I don't know where that takes us, but couldn't be found. I guess that's bad to me. What is it?
That's a good question. That's supposed that she's destroyed. She received it.
Exactly. So you want to say that she has the will, right? It's still valid. When it arrived in your mailbox, it was still a valid will. It had not been revoked, she says. Now, Testator takes it into their house, and then, after that, it can't be found. So she wants to infer from that the testator must have destroyed it with the intent to revoke it. Interesting? So she's saying, let's argue that when the will can't be found, and we know it had been in the testator's possession, the testator must have destroyed it. Got it? See your argument? And there is, in the law, common law, a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that if the testator has the original and it cannot be found after death, that the testator destroyed it with the intent to revoke it. It's a rebuttable presumption. And in this case, of course, says we are invoking that presumption. And the person who wants to argue that the will remain valid has the burden of overcoming this presumption, of rebutting this presumption. They have come in with no evidence to rebut it. By the way, it's difficult to rebut this presumption in this case, right? Don't you think? Why is it difficult to rebut the presumption? Let's say you represent now the person who wants to get the will admitted to probate. You're the beneficiary. You want to get that will admitted to probate. Go ahead. Try and rebut the presumption. How are you going to do it? You don't. Well, more problematically, you're faced with what? How are you going to show the testator didn't intend to revoke if we have all this evidence that the testator had called the lawyer and said, revoke, revoke, revoke? The testator's intent gift is perfectly clear on the facts. Overwhelming. And so very difficult, indeed impossible, to revoke the presumption in this case. And the court says the will was revoked. End of story. The presumption was triggered. It's a rebuttable presumption. The proponent of the will, the person seeking the will to probate, has come in with no evidence to rebut it, no evidence of contrary intent, that this was not the testator's intent, because it showed the testator wanted to keep this will. Indeed, there was no such evidence. And therefore, the will was revoked by virtue of this presumption. Got it? As a result of this presumption. Now, I think that was a creative argument, don't you? I mean, I think the presumption is an interesting presumption. I mean, it's there, but, you know, this is a creative argument in this case. I mean, typically, the way the presumption gets invoked is, you know, let's say it takes the will home with them. Let's say it takes the original home with them. And then after they die, it can't be found. And we infer through this presumption that rebuttable presumption that they must have destroyed it with the intent to revoke it. And that's the way it typically comes up. By the way, let me stop for a second. This is a good reason for thinking about where the will should be kept. If you just throw it in the drawer and then it can't be found, you face the prospect of this presumption. And so this is a good reason for thinking about where that will should be kept, so that it should be kept in a place where everybody knows it can't be reached. It should not be carelessly thrown around, and then you can't find it and you wind up with a presumption. Lawyers will sometimes, well, many lawyers will be happy to keep the original in their files, in their safe deposit box. Why would lawyers like to do that? Why would lawyers like to do that? So they're warding off, he says, the presumption. Protecting against the possible application of presumption. What else? What's closer to the lawyer's self-interest that might account for their desire to keep these wills in their files? The money entrusted to estate practice, as a practical matter, is more on the side of post-death than pre-death. Pre-death, you do the will. You get a certain fee for it, but you know, it may not be that extensive. That's significant. Post-death, you can get hired to probate the will and administer the estate. It's a lot of time involved. And so the legal fees are much more significant in the post-death administration of the estate than in the pre-death drafting of the will. Why does having the will give you an upper hand in terms of getting retained on the administration side of things? They call you, right? They're going to call you, exactly. They're going to call you and they're going to say, I need the will, I need to go to the probate. And when you get that phone call, you get the first crack at offering the exactly. And they say, how do you do it? You start the conversation, of course, and then you get into talking about, you know, retention. And so it gives you a first shot. Now, by the way, could you do this? Could you say, I'm not going to give you the will unless you do my services? No, absolutely not. It would be like that. Probably criminal. I think about why, what crime it would be, but I imagine there's one out there. Okay. Might even be death. It's not your property. Okay. Now, people have ethics questions have been raised about this. Can you, as an attorney, offer the client when they're leaving the office after you've done the will, oh, by the way, why don't you leave it with me? Is that ethical? And at least one bar association has suggested they thought it was unethical to offer your services in that regard. Because they were concerned, what was the concern? That you're fishing, if you were trying to, secure the client improperly. And, can't think of the word, losing the word, what's the word I'm looking for? Soliciting a further matter. Thank you. Solicitation of a further matter. I think other bar associations probably, I think it's one bar association that's come out that way. It's a very common practice, though, for lawyers to offer this. So we want to look at your state to see if there's any ethics issue with offering. The client, clearly, I think if the client said to you, I'd like to keep it, if you hold it, sure, you need to. But the question is one bar association raises, could you offer it? It's kind of an interesting question. Okay, but that's connected, as you can see, to this presumption, right? Because the whole point of having it in safe place is concern about the presumption that it needs to be revoked if it can't be found. And it was in the testator's possession. So notice, if the lawyer keeps the original, is there a presumption? Let's say the lawyer keeps the original and it can't be found post-death. The lawyer loses it. Presumption or not? No presumption. Why? Because it wasn't in the testator's possession. Now, why do we have this presumption? And let's go back to the case. Let's go back for a moment to Harrison v. Byrd. So, I think that Harrison v. Byrd is a very unusual application of the presumption. Usual conventional application of presumption, as I've said, is the testator has possession of the original, can be found after the death, okay, fine. But in this case, of course, it was the testator got this ripped up thing. You know what probably happened? When the testator got it, what do you think they did? Opened the mail and said, huh, I wonder why the lawyer sent me this. Opened the ripped up pieces and threw it in the garbage. Is that a revocation? Well, maybe if you want to say that there was an intent to revoke all the law and the will remained valid because the lawyer is ripping it up and didn't do anything, so now I get it and it's valid and I throw it away, maybe there's a physical act. So it's creative use of testosterone, I think, by the lawyers in this case. Kind of an interesting creative use of the doctrine. In any event, I want to now talk for a moment about why we have this doctrine. Why did we say that it can't be found after death? It's rebuttably presumed to have been revoked. Why do we do that? What's the thought here?
Well,
Well, I guess maybe this is what you were suggesting before, that if it can't be found, isn't it fair that you ripped it up intending to revoke it? Good inference? Maybe that's fair. But let me ask you this. Isn't it also possible that it's just this way? But I guess I'm trying to test with you the strength of this, of the logic of this inference. Are you really persuaded that if it can't be found that it was intended to be revoked? I shouldn't say it's not the case, but I will. In my house, if something can't be found, we don't automatically assume that we intentionally threw it out. We automatically assume that we put it somewhere and can't remember where we put it, so we go up on a search looking for it. Isn't that your experience in your house? Right? And you ever say, we can't find it. Must have been thrown away on purpose. Somebody looked at it and said, we don't need this anymore, let's throw it away. No. The more likely the inference type thing is we misplaced it. So, on the other hand, I guess someone says, well, we did a scrupulous search. We searched the whole house and we couldn't find it. And therefore, maybe the inference. Maybe where the law is really coming from here is this. Maybe the law is not terribly happy about the idea of probating documents that no longer physically exist. Maybe the law is saying, all right, look, we understand. There may be cases out there where a will will not be physically in existence. And we'll have to say, look, it wasn't revoked, and therefore we got to admit this non-existent document to probate. But you know what? We're not happy about it. I mean, how do you prove the terms? What did the will say? We're going to do all that mess. So, maybe the law is saying, look, we want to narrow down the cases where we're going to have to think about admitting to probate a document that no longer exists. And this doctrine helps us narrow down that category of cases. You see that? So maybe that's another part of what's going on here, behind the scenes, in terms of why we have this doctrine. Yes? Sure.
What about if I have my will as an attorney, I took the will of my client, I don't know it. And his family doesn't know that I have a will. What's next? And I find out after 20 years that he died. And I have his will. But nobody knows.
Okay, so you have the original will, and nobody knows about it.
Yeah. Only me and my client that he died.
Only you and your client know about it. He's dead. So, and you don't know he died.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if he died, I imagine you have an ethical obligation to go forward and let somebody know that you have the will.
How come? I mean, I have to check out?
No, I don't think you have to check and keep looking through the obituary notices every day.
Yeah.
You have to hire a secretary to check the obituary notices.
I don't think
you have that obligation. But let's say you do know that they don't. And they don't have the will. Don't you think you should tell them that they have the will? No, of course, that's what I'm saying. But if you don't know, you don't know, then you're not going to be able to do this. And you're not going to be able to tell the family. And it's plausible that they won't find out. And they'll go forward on the assumption that there was no will. And there's nothing that can be done about it as a practical matter. Now, years later, you come up and you say, oh, I have a will.
Yeah.
Right? Now, they have a will. And the person who's the beneficiary of the will says, can I get this money? Can I get this will admitted to the program? Now, I think the answer is that I've thought about hypothesis before, but I think the answer would probably be something like this. If you're in a jurisdiction like New York, okay, I think you probably could come in and get that will admitted to probate. That would be my guess. My sense would be the person who would benefit under the will could now come in and say, well, now I want to get the money. Turns out there wasn't due will. Okay? Now, maybe there's an argument that did the family members, did this person, the beneficiary under the will, were they guilty of some laches? Or did they not look for it? Did they not do anything? Maybe there's an estoppel argument that they should be estopped by their failure to pursue this. Could be, there are some cases in New York talking about how you could be estopped to probate a will if you took certain, didn't do certain things or did certain things that wound up prejudicing others. So maybe there's an argument like that. You have to look at that. I say in New York, I think you could do it. You could probate the will, subject to some kind of estoppel or laches type argument. In other states, some other states have a statute of limitations where after so many years after death, the will cannot be admitted to probate. And in a state like that, it would seem to me you'd probably get locked out by the time. That's my what happened. Yes.
What about the situation assumption that the original can't be found on copies of this? Is it still presumed?
Yes.
Those copies can't be in the news?
Yes, yes, absolutely. If the original cannot be, if the original was in the, let me restate the question. If you're saying we've got originals and copies. By the way, let me go back. Let's go back to Harrison B. Burke. Let me finish your question. You're saying we've got originals and we've got copies. And an original, is that your hypothetical? An original and copies. And the original was in Tessier's possession. And after death, it cannot be found. There's a rebuttal presumption that original was wrong. The copies, the fact that copies exist, are not relevant to the question of production. The presumption is true, even though copies exist. Indeed, go back to Harrison B. Burr. In Harrison B. Burr, there were two originals. Remember, the friend had an original, and the lawyer had the other original. And so, when the lawyer sent the original to the testator, and the testator had possession, and then it couldn't be found, that was enough to trigger the presumption, even though the friend had another duplicate original. So the loss of one original, if it was in the testator's possession, can't be found in the testator's possession, is sufficient to trigger the presumption, even if there's another original out there somewhere else. That's the way it works.
So why is the customer divorced about copies? And I have a couple of those that I've asked. They said, well, give a copy to your sister, give a copy to your brother, or whatever. Why is that? Why is it a suggestion?
Well, there's no harm in giving people a copy. And the point of the copy is not to deal with this presumption when breaking them off. But the point of the copy is to, first of all, a client wants to have a copy of the document. They want to look at it in their file. They want to say, what's my will say? Right? So they want to have a copy. That's one reason. A second reason why you have a copy is, let's say the original really does get lost accidentally. Right? Let's say the original does get lost accidentally. And the testator has been destroyed. There's no revocation. It's a document that's no longer in existence, but it can still be admitted to probate. Wouldn't it be nice to have a copy? So we can probate this document, saying to the court, here's a copy. The original was lost, but it was never properly revoked. You see the need for the copy? Got it with me? Okay, let me say one last thing, and then we'll break. Yes?
First question, I guess, is with the original giving a copy to someone else.
If the original is missing?
If one of the originals, if someone else has a copy.
No, I'm confused. It's, we have one original and copies.
Yes.
Okay.
But I guess the question is, someone would have to bring up the presumption.
Not necessarily. I can imagine more bringing up. I can imagine the court saying, if facts came out somehow, what we were aware of, where's the original? Where's the original? The court's going to say, we're not going to probate the copy, we want the original. Oh, the original's missing. Ah, what about the presumption? Did the testator have possession of it when they died? Yes, well, and this presumption is rebuttal.
So we have multiple originals, and if you present that, right?
Yes, but then you'd be concerned before, I suppose. If you brought in one original, you didn't tell the court that there was another original that had been in the testator's possession that was missing. I'm going to have trouble with that. Okay. All right, why don't we take a break? Thank you. Hi, Laura. Good. Quick question. How much more in the essence of the rules?
Thank you.
He's up there. He's there.
Terms of establishing the terms of the will.
you are going to have to show something like that or some other corroboration in order to get the will admitted to probate. when the actual will itself, the original, is missing or lost or destroyed. Okay. Now let's talk about Thompson versus Royal. In Thompson, this is a class, this is an important case in terms of revocation. In Thompson, what happened was this. The lawyer for the court, the testator had a will. And the testator was with her attorney, with the attorney, and two other witnesses. So there are three people in the room in addition to the testator. And the testator says, I'd like to revoke my will. The lawyer says, okay, give me the will. Takes the will. And turns it over. And on the blue back, you know, the backing of the will on the cover page, on the back of the cover page, the lawyer writes, this will null and void. So the lawyer writes that in their handwriting. This will null and void. And gives to the testator to sign. So the testator now signs underneath this inscription. As I say, two other witnesses were present. The testator dies. And the question is whether or not this was a valid revocation.
Valid revocation?
Well, let's try this one. Let's start this one. Let's look at it from the viewpoint of a physical act, revocation by physical act. So we have no ceremony. The witness is inside, we have no ceremony. Right. So let's try it. This pipe opens up a number of possibilities. Just sit there and wonder about all the different arguments one might have. Let's try. First, let's ask this question. Let's start this one. Would it have been a valid revocation by physical act if the testator had ripped it up? Let's start that. We're just reviewing it, right? If the testator had said, here, take the document, rip it up. Fine, rips it up. Good revocation? Absolutely. Next, would it have been a good revocation if the attorney had ripped it up in the presence of the testator? Let's say the attorney said, can we make a document? You want to revoke it? Yes, I ripped it up. Ripped up. Good revocation by physical act? In the Uniform Probate Code jurisdiction, it would be good, because if we didn't have two witnesses. If we had two witnesses in addition to the attorney ripping it up, we would be good even in New York, right? Same type of New York. With me? Okay. None of that happened to you, right? The attorney didn't rip it up, and the testator didn't rip it up. Okay. Next. So far, we haven't found a valid revocation yet. Agree? Next. What would have happened if the testator had written an X across each page? Good revocation? Yeah, revocation by physical act. What would have happened if the testator had written an X across the signature line? Across his signature, first signature. Good revocation? Yes, that would be good revocation by physical act. What if the attorney wrote an X across his page? The attorney said, I'll do the X. Good revocation? It's a physical act, it's instruction. But what do you need? You need two witnesses. If you're in New York, if you're in a UPC state, you don't need two witnesses. The next, written across the page, is a physical act, destruction, revocation. It's not like a writing. It's not like we're revoking this by a writing. We need witnesses. An X across the page is a physical act mutilation. You with me? It's a mutilation. What if the attorney had written null and void across each page? Or would it be a testator had done so? If the testator had said null and void across each page, that came very close. It's going to sound like what? but like perhaps not a physical act of revocation, but rather a writing. But I think the answer here is, if you've got some canceling language written across the will like this, it will be a mutilation. It will be a sufficient revocation by physical act. It will be that. So the testator wrote null and void across each page, good revocation. If the testator wrote null and void across the signature line, good revocation. If the attorney wrote null and void like this, it would be a good revocation if we had two witnesses in New York, and it's UPC, we don't need any witnesses. We're all together? Now, the question then will become in this case, whether what the attorney did, null and void, this will null and void, on the cover page, if that's a sufficient mutilation of the will. You see that? You see that? This is writing null and void on the cover page, a sufficient mutilation. We agree, no one disputes that if it were written on the page, cover, on the actual text of the will, null and void, that would be sufficient as a mutilation. The question becomes, is there a mutilation here that is sufficient to effect revocation when it's written on the cover page? And the court answers, no. The court holds that writing words across the will would be fine, but in this case, the words, the canceling words, did not come in contact with any part of the language of the will. Get it? What do you think? Why not?
The client's intent
is so overwhelming and clear. What are we doing? Well, you know what we're doing? We're again, in this context, in the revocation context, insisting on rigid formalities. The court holds that the canceling language must come in contact with the language of the will. It must come in contact with the language of the will. And here, it did not. Being on the cover page was not sufficient. And so this remained a common law rule. In fact, I believe, if you wrote it in the margin of the will, this would not be a sufficient revocation. There are cases applying Thompson versus Royal, saying, if it's in the margin, it didn't come into contact with the language of the will, and therefore, it's not a valid revocation. You've got to have it on the language of the will. That's what Thompson versus Royal holds. Now, and that is the common law rule. And she says she doesn't like the common law rule because she says, in a case like this, the testator's intent is so clear. What are we doing insisting on having it be placed in a particular way, in a particular place? Why can't we accept the testator's wishes? Why can't we respect the testator's wishes, which were expressly stated? It's very clear. So what other ideas do you have? Well, UPC comes back, and in their revocation statute, UPC 2-507, they explicitly overrule Thompson versus Royal, and say that it no longer needs to come into contact with the language of the will. So today, in a case like this, UPC would say that this is a valid revocation. Thompson versus Royal is expressly overruled. In New York, on the other hand, we don't have a statute like that, and we continue to adhere to the common law rule. And so, case like Thompson versus Royal coming up in New York today, the revocation would be ineffective. Under the UPC today, the revocation would be effective. Got it? Now, any other ideas about this kind of case? Say you get a case like this in a state that has not enacted 2507. You get a case like this where the state has not overruled Thompson versus Royal. So you get a state where Thompson versus Royal remains the rule, the common law rule. What do you do? What are you going to do? Well, what about harmless error or substantial bias? Why not say, look, there's clear and convincing convincing evidence of the testator's intent. And therefore, this little defect, they put the words in the wrong place on the will, should be excused. It's a harmless error. You see it? So I think that, of course, the UPC, which has a harmless error statute, you don't have to go there, because in its revocation statute itself, it's already overruled from it. So you just have to go to the revocation statute and find this is a good revocation. So you don't have to worry about going to harmless error. But in another state that has not yet enacted 2507, that has not overruled Thompson versus Royal, you could make the harmless error or substantial compliance argument, assuming, of course, the state embraces these arguments. Any other argument? Let's say the testator had written on the back of the will, this will null and void, and signed it. What would you now argue? Possibly argue this is a holographic revocation. In other words, so for the first time we see that the holographic will statute could be utilized in the context of revocation. Until now, we talked about holographic wills, we talked about a will. Now we see that you might have if you're in a state that has a holographic will statute, you could do a revocation by a document constituting a holographic will. Of course, it would have to be in the handwriting of the testator. In this case, it wasn't. In this case, it was the attorney's handwriting. So what I think you all think, this revocation should be respected, but in common law state like New York, you know what I think the answer would be, Ben? This case came up in New York, Ben? I think the answer would be, we're going to go with Thompson versus Royal. That's a common law rule. We have not abolished it, number one. Number two, we do not have substantial compliance or harmless error. We have not enacted the harmless error statute. We don't have any substantial compliance in our case law. And therefore, we're not a holographic will state. And therefore, I think that in New York, this revocation would be, as it was in Thompson versus Royal, ineffective. Trouble, is it not? Trouble. And that's why you see doctrines like substantial compliance and harmless error coming into the law in order to remedy this kind of problematic outcome, where there's a little technical defect. But the intent is clear. Questions? All right, let's turn to another subject. Partial revocation by physical act. Partial revocation by physical act. Let me give you an example of what I mean, so you're clear, because I think when I say the headline is partial revocation by physical act, it's going to have to be. Let's see what we're talking about. Let's say that we have a will, which says, I give my house to A, and I give my residue to B. Okay, so I give my house to A, my residue to B. Now, let's say that I take out a pen and I write across the pre-residuary gift of the house to A, this gift null and void. Got it? This gift null and void. And that's all. Now, I want to know who gets the house. So, the first, I lose you? You with me? I lost you. Okay, I'm going to get it. Will says, I give the house to A, and I give my residue to B. Right? It's all very simple. Will. Then I come along sometime later, and I take out a pen, and I write across the gift of the house to A. Article 1. It's Article 1. I write this gift, null and void. No. It's a perfectly valid will. Let me find one. Perfectly valid will. Let's say it was executed with two witnesses. Everything's proper about it. But then a year or two later, I decide I want to revoke. I don't want the house to let it in. I'd like B to get the house to let it. B's getting the residue. I'd like B to get it. I don't want A. I fight with A. I want the house to let it in with the rest of the residue. So I just write across that clause, which gives the house to A, in the will. I say, I take out my pen and I say, this clause null and void. With this gift null and void. What do you think? Not a good reputation. Why not?
Because the two witnesses on New York and
Alright, let's slow it up. Could I do it this way? Let's slow it up. Could I do it this way? I come to you and I say, look, I don't want the house to go to A anymore. So could you do a document to me that would revoke the gift to A? Yeah, you could do a couple things. You could write a whole new will saying, I give my whole residue to B. Period, right? No question about that. You agree? Could you do a codicil, C-O-D-I-C-I-L, which is a will, but it only amends the existing will. It's not a whole new will, it only amends a piece of the existing will. So could you say, in this codicil, I am amending the will to remove the bequest to the demise of the house to A, so that it goes to B. Could you do that? Yes, absolutely. So you could do a partial revocation of the will by doing a new document. You ready? Partial thing. You don't have to revoke the gift to the residue of B. You can just revoke the gift of the house to A. So then it will go to B. Yes? Absolutely. We need two witnesses, she says, for this codicil. You need this codicil will not be valid unless it complies with the statute of wills. Absolutely must comply with the ceremonial requirements in Kimberly statute. No question about it. So that would be a partial revocation. Remember, I started this with the headline of a partial revocation by physical act. And what we've done in the process of this discussion is we just talked about a partial revocation by a writing executed in accordance with the statute of wills. But now I want to come back to my hypo. And I want to ask you again, can we accomplish or achieve a partial revocation by physical act in the fashion I'm suggesting? In other words, can I partially revoke the will by physical act? Now I no longer want to do a writing, I want to just do it by physical act. Null and void, this gift null and void. And then have the, as a result of that, have the gift fall into the residuary. Can I do that? And the answer is that in many states you may not do this. In New York, for example, partial revocation by physical act is not respected. Why not? Well, what did we say before? When we set this discussion up today, we said that we're not as strict on revocation as we are in execution. Lower hurdles for revocation, right? Because why? Because you're going back to a natural state of affairs, and that's a natural disposition, right? Well, when I revoke partially a clause in the will, one clause in the will, and have it go to the residue, right? What am I doing? Am I going back to intestacy? I'm taking the gift of the real estate of A and giving it to B. I'm not going to intestacy. So it's like I'm making a new gift. I've decided to give the house to B. And New York says, if you want to give the house to B, feel free, but do a document executed in accordance with the statute of wills. We're not going to let you get there without execution ceremony. See it? You can see on the other hand, in 2507, the revocation statute, I keep citing, explicitly says that a partial revocation by physical act is permitted. And so they will respect the testator's wishes. So if the testator says, I revoke this clause, I revoke this gift, it would fall into the residue. Where would it go in New York? A would continue to get the gift. Even though the testator wrote, I want to revoke this gift to the house to A. In New York, A, we continue to get the house because in New York, this would not be a valid revocation. By the way, even if you're in a state that doesn't respect partial revocation by physical act, what might you do? You're B. You're in a state, I tell you, you represent B. Right? You're in a state that does not respect partial revocation by physical act. It is not adopted the UPC 2507 statute. What could you argue? It's clear the testator wrote this request null and void, so what do you want to argue? Harmless error, substantial compliance. You want to say, even though the revocation might not have been valid, any defect in the revocation should be excused under harmless error or substantial compliance. You know, who knows how far this document is going to be pushed out there? You know, who knows what courts will accept? But these are really interesting documents that do, you know, kind of constitute an escape valve. so that, you know, if there's really clear evidence of what the testator intended, courts might be willing to try and bail you out with one of these doctrines. You have to see, assuming your jurisdiction embraces one of these doctrines, voluntarily or substantially. Okay, next subject. Is, I would call this subject the question, subject of revival. Revival. And here's what this is about. Let's take an example. Let me do it this way. Let me start off with this heading, and then we'll take an example. You won't get the heading. If I say it in the abstract, it won't be clear, but let's try it, and then we'll do it. Okay? So the question that we have to ask here, question of revival, I don't know if I'm going to finish it, but the question of revival is this. Does the revocation of an instrument of revocation, does the revocation of an instrument of revocation revive the original? In that fashion, you have no idea what you're talking about. See if we can dig into this a little bit. Let's take an example. Here's what I'm thinking. Let's say that will number one gives a residue to A. And then in will number two, I give no express revocation rules, but let's say I give the residue to B. So the gift to A is squeezed out by inconsistency. It's revoked. And now, by God, B gets it. And then, later on, before I die, I take out will number two and I revoke it. I rip up will number two. So I physically revoke will number two. And the question here is, does the revocation of rule number two, which is itself an instrument of revocation, you see that? Rule number two was an instrument of revocation in that it was revoking will number, the gift in will number one. So now the question is, does my destruction of will number two have the effect of reviving will number one? You see the question? So when I rip up will number two, so we now say that A gets the real estate, gets the residue. What did I get for that problem? What did I say? What was A getting in number one? Okay. So now when I rip up rule number two, does A get the residue? Or alternative. When I rip up rule number two, do we now say I die intestate and give it to my intestate heirs? You want to give it to A?
Yeah.
You want to give it to A? Okay, well. Anybody else want to give it to intestate heirs? You want to give it to intestate heirs? Why?
Because I think that the intention of the testator was to no longer give the gift to A.
So she thinks the testator decided to destroy the gift to A, revoke the gift to A, and then they decide to give it to B, and they decide to revoke the gift to B, and now they have no will. They have no will. Right. So therefore, you have to say they decide to die without will, and therefore you give it to the intestate heirs. Okay, let's see how the law answers this question, right? We give it to back to A, we revive the gift back to A, or we give it to the intestate heirs. By the way, can you see why I call the question of revival? Whether the revocation of number two has the effect of reviving will number one. That's the question we have to wrestle with. And the answer is that there are three possible approaches to this question. In different jurisdictions. And let's go through the three approaches. The first approach, which was the common law approach. Under the common law, will number two was viewed as a cover. A cover. What I mean by a cover is like a cover. Covering will number one. So in other words, first he did number will number first he did will number one. Those of you who are on this in my hand, you can't see what I'm doing, my hands are just crippled. First we have will number one. First you have will number one, and then will number two is covering one. And then when will number two is revoked, the cover is that's the key part, right? The cover is removed. Will number two is revoked. The cover, acting as a cover, will number two is now removed. And what happens? Will number one springs back to life. Follow? So, in other words, will number one was never really dead. It was just kind of being dormant. It was covered up. when will number two gets revoked, will number one says, ah, I'm back on the scene. I'm valid. Because I was never really revoked to attention. And that, I like to call that cover approach. Common law approach with the cover approach. That's one approach. The second approach, which is the New York approach, and we see this in other jurisdictions as well, is what I like to call the destruction approach. Destruction approach. Like destroy, destruction. And our statute in New York, which deals with the question of revival, and which takes this so-called destruction approach, is EPDL 3-4.6. 3-4.6. So what does 3-4.6 say? Well, it says that when will number one was revoked, when will number one was revoked, it was, by will number two, it was destroyed. Destruction, destroyed. Dead, gone. It's no longer dormant. It's not like it's being covered. It is dead. And therefore, what does that mean? What is the import of this? Well, when will number two is now revoked, guess what happens to will number one? It remains dead. It does not spring back to life. So I guess what New York is saying, and states like New York are saying, is, look, you know, just because you revoked will number two doesn't enable us to infer that you want to go back to that original will. We prefer to think that when you revoke will number two, you probably at this point want to go to the intestines. We're not going to infer that you want to go back to some earlier will. Okay? So once will number one is dead, it's dead. Revoke, it's dead. That's the structure. Now, along comes Uniform Probate Code. And the Uniform Probate Code, true to its spirit, as we've seen time and time again, says this essentially. It says, let's get rid of hard and fast, inflexible, rigid rules. And we think, and I'm just putting on paraphrasing, putting my own spin on what they're thinking, but you know, we think. And I'll tell you what the rules actually are, probably on Monday. But we think that we should not have a hard and fast cover approach. Nor should we, like a common law, nor should we have a hard and fast destruction approach, like we do in New York. Instead, we should have an approach that gives adequate respect to the testator's intent. And so let's make this question of revival hinge upon what we think the testator intended. Okay, so let's look at what the testator intended. And this section of UPC that deals with the question is UPC 2-509. 2-509. And in aiding our process or our task of trying to define the testator's intent, we are going to see two presumptions that UPC gives us. And so the entity of it on Monday will start by looking at these two productions, and then I'll give you a case where you all can show you how it works out. So we'll finish up. We have a little bit more to do on arrival, and then we'll keep moving forward on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Repeating it. job the next day, and I'm just like,
I love her.
screened off the time, they may not be able to do that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and then on top of that, too, it's the front end. And this is the thing that we know right there. The front end is a limited partner where monkeys from that, and you just want them off. Nobody wants to see this. It's not available. You don't know the address. How can you spread it out? You have no confidence in the information. You have
no confidence in that on the example where she's going
to be. Yeah, we have this whole thing. I got it. And you're just like, no, 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 no. And yeah. And then I looked at the rule, and I was like, one of the common things that kids have that kind of need that confidence, and that confidence is like, if they have no confidence on the smaller one, not needed to the front, but the body is not trying to prove that, there's no access for that, but that makes sense, right? And if I have no one who can ever be able to identify, you just fucking get confident, right? That's why they're trying to, like, the more I think about it, the less I know.
Thank you.